Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official podcast of the American Humanist Association. What do we got today, Todd?
We have prunes as the official food of Evacuation Day, kind of like turkeys on Thanksgiving. We've got charming con artists, the bright side of death, the band Journey, or not, leaps of secular faith, all as we do a whirlwind of four authors.
Woohoo! Welcome to the show, everybody.
Hi, listeners. This is Todd.
And this is Kim.
We've got a crazy show for you, a little different format than usual. We are going to hit four interviews in 1 hour. That's right. We have four different authors, and we are just going to plow right through like maniacs, hitting different authors and topics. It's going to be a fun month.
Left and right, authors flying through the air, coming in, coming down.
Oh, my gosh. That reminds me of the scene in History of the World Part 1 where... Yes. He's playing the king, and he's like shoots the peasants across the air in the catapult. It's good to be the king.
It is.
Why don't the peasants like me? Paul.
Okay. Oh,
yes.
No.
So we will pull the authors and shoot them across the sky throughout the episode.
Yes, and then a nice shower of all of their amazing works will fall upon our listeners and make the world a better place.
Something like that. So what's going on in the news, Kim?
There's a lot going on. You know what? I was actually wondering what's been going on with you and the Supreme Court of the United States, Todd.
I'm not doing anything with the Supreme Court of the United States personally, except praying that they will make the right decision in the Greece case. The town of Greece versus Galloway case is being heard by the Supreme Court. And that is a pretty critical case because what's basically up for grabs is sectarian prayers. This has been decided by the Supreme Court before, but is getting decided again. In the past, the ruling was our government can pray as long as they're not praying to a specific God. Well, that's been getting ruthlessly ignored, and people are praying in Jesus' name all over the place. And so the Supreme Court's going to have to make a decision. It's going to be a tough one because we've got clowns like, and I'll say it, he's a clown, Scalia, who... He's up there for political reasons. He's not there trying to do what the Constitution says. And it's going to be a close call given the makeup of the court. But I find the case interesting because the defendant in this case is the town of Greece. It is a government. It's not an individual. It's not a citizen. It's not citizens' rights we're talking about. We are talking about a lawsuit that essentially is a town, a government, claiming that they should be able to pray in the name of Jesus Christ. To me, I don't even understand why this is an issue, given we have a First Amendment in our Constitution. Since when does the government have religious liberty? Since when does the government have the right to choose one religion over another, one God over another, choose, you know, Allah in one town and Jesus in Greece? It's a little bit of a scary case. To me, the government doesn't have religious liberty, just like corporations shouldn't be considered people, but you know, this is one of those cases where if it goes the wrong way, yeah, this could be devastating. It could open the door to local governments across the country picking favorite sects, right down to, you know, in Brooklyn, you could have a local Jewish government that only prays Jewish prayers, and you could go to Michigan and, you know, highly concentrated Islamic areas, and you could have Islamic official government prayers. That's their favorite local religion. It's a little crazy, actually.
I wonder in the world of theory, if that would finally make people understand what we're talking about when we say that freedom of religion also has to be freedom from religion. Maybe it will take that kind of pendulum swing to that side of crazy to make people who don't quite get it actually see what it is we're talking about.
Yeah, I'm afraid for them to see it, it's going to require the Supreme Court messing up the Greece case, allowing governments to pray, and then ending up with a town like Dearborn, Michigan, which is over 40% Muslim and growing. It was where that Muslim reality TV show was filmed. I could see a town like Dearborn 5-10 years from now, demographic shift enough, if it goes majority Muslim, if this ruling goes one way, you literally could see Muslim prayers opening every meeting. And then you will finally see the Christians realizing, oops, wow, this was nice when we were in the majority almost everywhere. Uh-oh.
Yeah. Like, wasn't it down, yeah, in Alabama with Bobby Jindal and the school vouchers? where one of their representatives was like, oh, we meant they were for Christian schools, not for Muslim schools.
Yeah, we want to be able to pray in the name of Jesus, not Allah. That's crazy.
Yeah, don't be crazy, people. Well, we'll keep our eye on that for sure.
Yeah, ruling should be out in several months. I'm guessing like the spring or summer next year. It takes them a while to decide, but... Yep, it's a very, very important case. One of the biggest church state cases to go all the way to the Supreme Court in a long time.
Excellent. Well, good work, everybody. Keep up the fight.
Indeed. So, who is our first author today?
Todd, today we are going to start out with Susan Perry, Ph.D. She is a writer, a novelist, and a social psychologist. She has done some amazing work in the nonfiction world. And she became curious about how other writers accomplish their feats of creativity, like her husband, who we will also speak to today, Stephen Perry, who is a poet. Susan has written a Los Angeles Times bestseller, Writing in Flow, Keys to Enhanced Creativity, and she'll talk to us a little bit about that as well. Today she is going to talk to us about her first work of fiction, Kylie's Heel, which is now available in ebook or paperback. We have a story of Kylie Moran, who is a humanist advice columnist in her local newspaper, and she has her world, I guess, turned upside down when her son goes on a missionary trip with her more fundamentalist twin sister. Is that a good synopsis?
Yes, I would say so.
Welcome to the show. Tell our listeners about how you treated the themes of kind of humanism and how you used humanism to kind of help your characters along.
I basically wrote out my worst fears as a person and as a mother. And there was no question of Kylie in Kylie's Heel having any other thing to depend on but her humanism and her secularism and her atheism. I come right out and she comes right out and calls herself an atheist. That's the only way I could see to do it. Otherwise, I'd be really making it up. So I used my worst fears and my belief system to help my character get through a really tough time.
How does Kylie's atheism and humanism help her cope through the challenges she goes through during the course of the book?
It really takes a long time. Towards the end, she's debating whether, you know, to be or not to be, really, which is everyone's real question when you don't believe that there's another life coming along, either for you or your loved ones. She eventually accepts that, is all I can say. She accepts it like atheists and agnostics and humanists pretty much have to. But we go through all of that back and forth thinking with her. So the people, a couple of reviewers have said it was as if they lived through it themselves. And why I don't want to read it again, because having read it so many times, it's like going through a great loss and having to work out that whole existential thing all over again. Okay, there's nothing left. Why should I live? But she does find that as a good existentialist, there is something to live for.
As we mentioned in when we were telling our listeners about who you are and what you've done, you have written a lot of nonfiction in the past, and this is your first jump to fiction. Can you tell us a little bit about what that was like for you?
When I married a poet, well, it was just 30 years ago now, when I married a poet, I was jealous of the way he could get lost in his writing. And I had been a journalist for local magazines and national magazines, covering every kind of topic. And eventually I got bored with that. You can't make up anything. You must stick to the truth. And you also must do what your editors have assigned you to do or will buy. So eventually I decided, I think I want to try fiction. And I did. And all my learning took place on the job. So that's why it took several years, too many years, to complete the book to the satisfaction of a publisher and actually get it out in the world. It's a big switch, but I want to do it again. Cool. I don't want to go back to just writing, you know, regular, like real stuff.
Well, apparently you did a good job learning on the job, if you will, because you just won the IndieBookOfTheDay.com award.
Yay.
I guess it's an eponymous award.
we're trying to get some nice applause, an applause button so that we can clap.
Yeah, that was nice, and my sales jumped a little bit.
I bet. That's awesome. Congratulations on that.
Yep. Oh, thank you.
How did that happen? Do you apply to try to get it? Do they just notice you or?
The publisher, Brian and Humanist Press, apply for that. And when you fit whatever it is they're looking for, good reviews and a good book, they choose one a day, apparently. And I got it. And I'm happy.
Well, that is awesome.
I have to figure out where to stick the sticker.
and for our listeners, Brian, who was just mentioned at Humanist Press, is also Brian McGee, our fearless producer for the show. So thank you to Brian, who's always behind the scenes and doesn't get a whole lot of recognition.
Men of many talents.
Indeed, indeed.
Who also needs our non-existent applause button.
Yeah, Brian.
One of the things that I was thinking about, Susan, as I was perusing your book is, you know, one of the things that's in the press right now, I don't know if you're aware of this, is that Oprah Winfrey had come out and informed an atheist that she wasn't an atheist because she believed in beauty and essentially had her own redefinition of what atheism is. And I was thinking of your book with the two sisters and their thoughts on each other and trying to connect.
Well, I don't have a sibling, so I really got to make that up. But I've had a couple of fundamentalist friends that I've been able to talk to and actually interviewed them in a way. One, I said, well, actually both. I said I was interviewing them, so they knew it. And I took notes, and I made up this sibling. And I imagine if you're twins, even not identical, you'd be very, very close. But as your philosophy split apart that way, one an atheist, one wanting to be, you know, actually a missionary in Africa spreading the word of God, there would be some trials there. And they start out the book being open, or at least Kylie is open, to understanding her sister, her fundamentalist sister. It doesn't end up quite so close. Kylie blames her sister for dragging her son on this mission. So, I mean, there's a whole story there. You might have to read it.
Is Kylie named after anyone in particular?
No, it's been a while. I did look up all the names that I was going to use and see what they meant, and there are various allusions. There's Kylie Tennant is from the turn of the last century, I believe, an Australian writer, and that's who I actually named her after, and there's a place in the book where I show all the commonalities, where Kylie herself discovers the commonalities between herself and this early atheist. So it's not after anyone I know.
I wonder if a few people actually heaved a sigh of relief there.
Well, they're supposed to like her.
They just don't want to be outed.
This is the first time, actually, that I've written anything, that I had written anything where I got to put my own views and be absolutely outed as an atheist. And since then, I've taken on some blogs where I do that. And it's really kind of liberating. And I only have this tiny little fear in the back of my mind that the barbarian hordes are going to descend on our house and attack both Stephen and me.
You mean it hasn't happened yet?
No, nothing.
You'd probably see.
That's good. Well, that would sell more books, right? But I don't want to die yet.
Yeah, you do need balance, correct?
In your first journey into the world of fiction, were there any kind of ideas that you wanted to work into some of the subplots of the story? And if so, how did you do that?
Well, I wanted to set it in the neighborhood in which I live, and I did. Subplots, as with many first novels, tend to be somewhat autobiographical. So the ex-husband, has some familiar traits to me. And some of the conversations between mother and son are actually from a journal that I kept years ago and adapted. Some of the dreams that I had when I was dealing with an empty nest, a few of them stayed in the book. I eliminated most. Reading other people's dreams is really not that much fun. But I shortened them and tightened them and used a few where they might work.
I might have to give that quote to my 9-year-old daughter, who starts every day by explaining to me for 10 minutes what she dreamed about last night.
It's very hard to get that across to kids.
Yeah, well, yeah. I don't know, but you two clearly aren't having as interesting of dreams as I'm having, because I think mine are fascinating.
Well, write them down, and maybe you can use them someday.
I'd probably have to tell them to a shrink more than a general audience.
That's why I don't want to be a shrink.
Because you don't want to know Todd's dreams. That's probably well, very wise.
Probably don't.
Not specifically, but...
Well, is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know about your book or your journey in writing it?
The book I wrote before that, or a couple of books before that, was called Writing in Flow. And I learned that if you're lucky, you get into this trance-like flow state where you're just having such a good time writing that you, or any other thing, that you want to keep doing it whether you're paid or not. And I guess that's what happened with Kylie's Heel. I really did enjoy it. And it took a long time, and money just ends up not being a big part of the equation. Someone wants to write a novel, learn how, and don't just write a draft and send it out. I learned that because even with all my experience writing for a long time, you tend to think, oh, this is great, or it's terrible, and you hide it away. But if you think it's great and you send it out, it's inevitably premature.
Speaking of Todd's dreams.
Oh. And that's about it. But I think, as with all literary fiction, and this is called literary fiction, saying what it's about does not tell you what it's about. So you have to take a little leap of, whoops, secular faith, and read the book, and you will be drawn in. People say they couldn't put it down, and wow, you know, men have said they couldn't put it down. Not people I actually know, except through, you know, Twitter and all. Like, wow, men can't put it down.
It was for that sex scene.
Oh, there's one really good sex scene, but it's way late. No, I don't think that's it. That's just a guy
you just
thinking.
You just hooked our listeners, male and female. Why didn't you say there was a sex scene at the beginning?
There's... Oh, well,
I... The switchboard's just lit up, folks, now. Thank you, Susan, so much for being on the show. We really appreciate it.
Okay. And our joint website, by the way, Stephen's and mine, is Bunny Ape, in case anyone is listening and isn't looking at all the little things on the side that say that. B-U-N-N-Y-A-P-E, like a little furry animal. You know, me, and a big one, like Stephen, Bunny Ape.
Is that a .com or a .net or a .org?
.com. And there are excerpts from our books and all the raves, and Stephen has a list of favorite books and atheist books. There's a lot on that site, so if you have an extra minute.
Go check it out. Excellent. Thank you so much, Susan.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Listeners, we have for you now Stephen Perry, the author of Questions About God. This is a book of poems that has been called an excitingly different read by the New York Journal of Books, as well as challenging and thought-provoking. There is everything from humanist interests to skeptics, agnostics, and atheists. A little something for everyone, I think.
His poetry has been anthologized in the Bedford Anthology of Literature. He is also a professor of creative writing. And interestingly enough, he was once hired as a poetry consultant for Disney.
Excellent.
His poetry has been published in journals such as The New Yorker, The Yale Review, and Virginia Quarterly Review. Oh, welcome to the show, Stephen.
Well, thank you. I'm real glad to be here.
Thank you for joining us on the show today. It's awesome to have you here. This is my first question for you, is just about how you see poetry as helping the humanist cause, and I guess also how you work humanism into your work.
Well, there was a book that was the genesis for me of the book. That was Richard Dawkins' Unweaving the Rainbow. And it was a call to creative artists of all sorts, maybe even particularly emphasizing poets, to participate in using scientific themes to evoke what's called the wonder of the universe in a humanist secular way without imaginary creatures at the fringe. It struck me that, yes, we should be participating, all creative artists. So I've taken that up. You can get at humanist themes in a number of different ways. One way is simply to point out, let's say, fallacies in presuming an all-good God, the problem of evil and the incompatibility of that with a God in the universe is something that I deal a lot with.
I was actually thinking about Unweaving the Rainbow, and I hadn't read that one, and I was thinking that I need to find it.
It's a wonderful book. I think it's one of Dawkins' less read and therefore less appreciated works, but he is as vehement and adamant about bringing, again, a scientific point of view into the arts. Some artists get it right, some artists don't. In England, I had a talk with some falconers, and I said, oh, that's great. I'll write a poem about it. And he says, well, if you do, please get it right. Nobody who writes about this form of birding gets it right. They'll have peregrine falcons hunting in forest scenes, and that just doesn't happen. So I suppose one of the things artists should conscientiously do is get their scientific facts correct.
I think that's definitely something that I struggle with sometimes when I'm watching like movies and the like, whereas I can accept a certain suspension of disbelief, but don't violate the laws of physics. that part I can suspend and think like in Jurassic Park. Okay, fine. They brought back dinosaurs. Like, all right, fine. They got really great technology, but don't put a little kid in an electric fence that can hold back a T-Rex and he just like pops off. It's just fine. It's just, you know, it's just a little singed at the edges. He's okay. So I found that a line in Hourglass was kind of interesting. It says, all you have that is beautiful, you will lose. And that actually reminds me of a line from a Flaming Lips song. It's a band often with humanist lyrics and words where they say, do you realize that everyone you know someday will die? Are you kind of trying to get across a similar message to that, do you think? What were you trying to say there? And do you see an uplifting side to that?
I'm glad you asked that, because I do see an uplifting side to that. Acknowledging what is frees you. The poet Wallace Stevens said, death is the mother of beauty, which is a startling phrase. But in order to fully live your life, you need to know this is all we have. And then you're more likely to expand yourself into that life. So that poem, which is probably in and of itself about the bleakest poem that you could get, and I wanted it to be darkly bleak, your head, almost your skull, like an hourglass, leaking out the sands of time, leaking out your vital essence, that will be gone, but it doesn't mean that we don't celebrate in the meantime the whole processes of nature.
I think we're okay. Yeah, it's definitely all around us, isn't it? The ebb and flow, especially this time of year in the autumn, I think. Thinking about the end of things, but maybe the end of things making way for the beginnings in a few months. It always makes me happy.
Me also, as long as that image is not co-opted as an image for physical rebirth. I read one Christian poem where it noted that life was coming back through the roots again of the deciduous trees, and then they were miraculously reborn. Well, all of that is fine, and all that process marvelous, except for the literalism of that. In strict fundamentalism, it's somehow you get ossified interpretations of metaphor, and that's not what they're about. The metaphors are suggestive of other kinds of process. I'll give you a brief, for instance. In the Bible, you have, for the creation of woman, a rib taken. And you have to think about that for a moment. This is a patriarchal culture co-opting the function of birth, and it's giving it to a man. So it's men all the way down. You have God creating Adam. Out of Adam, another subordinate creature. That rib is a further symbol for vitality. Within the bone itself, there's the marrow, which is nutritious, which gives sustenance. And that's another symbol for life out of death. Joseph Campbell used to say all of these metaphors none of the sophisticated in any religion take those literally. Now, I may have some disagreement with him on that. I do indeed think people are bone-brained enough to take those images literally. But when you start reading down through the metaphors of religion, I become horrified because of what it means about their world view. Again, say in hierarchical arrangement where God is the absolute top and must be obeyed absolutely. That's why we have the image of Lord. And I just recently read a book where in the Bible it talks about servants of God. Well, that's mostly a mistranslation. We are slaves of God. And if you buy into this, there's no room for individualistic thinking on your own. It's all channeled one direction from the big guy down.
When I first read the name of your book, Questions About God, it immediately struck me as curious as that it was in a humanist press, because to me, if I saw a book called Questions About God, I would immediately assume that the author was Christian or of some kind of religious belief. So that, I thought that was an interesting name for the title.
Yeah, and I didn't know until afterwards that there are Christian books out there, Questions About God, working within that constricted circle. But you may also notice that I put a photo of a Greek god from a museum. I presume it was Zeus. So it's not only questions about a Christian god, as our impoverished mindset would suggest, but a larger questions about gods of all traditions, all mythologies. And I do indeed move through Blackfoot mythology to Eastern mythology, and so on.
So I have, I guess, one last question before we move on. Listeners, we have Steve Perry on the line right now, and I'm just curious what it was like when you used to be the lead singer for the band Journey.
Ah! Oh, there was a period where it was wonderful. We would get teenage girls calling all the time, and Susan would put me on, and I'd chat with them, you know. I disappoint.
Oh my gosh, that's wonderful. Do you have the fist pump too?
Oh, well, believe it or not, I was in a rock band when I was young and played Farfisa organ. Where we really need secularism is in our music. So maybe we need to write cantatas and other forms. I don't know how it would be done, but I can imagine it.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for being on the show, and don't stop believing.
Okay.
So third in our list, we get to continue the catapult of authors. We have John G. Rodwin Jr. He's the author of books such as Fighters and Writers, which were boxing books, who has recently turned his attention to more of the humanist sphere of things. Rodwin writes frequently about literature, music, boxing, and humanism. Now he has had articles published in The American Interest, Free Inquiry, and The Humanist Magazine, which we are the official podcast of. We sprouted out of The Humanist Magazine. And he's also lived all over the world, places like New York, Geneva, and the very obscure Portland, Oregon.
Portland, Oregon. Nobody knows that place. Excellent. Good deal.
John, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, John is the author of Holidays and Other Disasters, full of history and personal stories, from what I understand. Is that right, John?
Yes, it is. The idea is there are stories that have a holiday connection, a holiday theme. Mostly they're my own stories, experiences I've had related to the holidays. In some cases, other people had some fascinating stories, so I told theirs instead, but usually they're my own experiences.
Creating the book, were there any kind of strange holidays you came across or that perhaps you celebrate in your daily life?
For a while, I lived in New York and learned of Evacuation Day, which was a holiday I'd never heard of before. And it turned out no one I knew in New York had heard of it either. But immediately after the end of the Revolutionary War, when British troops finally left New York, people celebrated that for a long time, too, but then it sort of fell out of favor. So around Thanksgiving, which is the same time of year, I thought, well, Evacuation Day is that's a really nice holiday. It's celebrating the same thing as 4th of July, but at the end of the war instead of the beginning, and it doesn't have any of the religious components that Thanksgiving sort of inherently does. So I sort of tried to convince friends, well, we should celebrate Evacuation Day instead of Thanksgiving, but no one really went for that. But I still kind of like the idea.
Evacuation Day kind of brings up a different connotation to me, so I appreciate you letting us know what that is, which is, it does sound lovely. Essentially getting all the soldiers out of our towns and cities, I guess, at that time, yeah?
Right.
It's good to know we're evacuating soldiers, though, nothing else as part of this holiday. So do you now celebrate Evacuation Day? And if not, what is your personal story connection to it?
Well, like I said, I kind of persuaded people that this would be, or tried to persuade people in New York that this would be a good alternative to Thanksgiving, but I couldn't really bring people around to it, which I guess I kind of understand. But my wife really likes to make the Thanksgiving meal, so, and she's a good cook, so I do go along with that one. But
maybe what you should have done was offer them a particular food. If you're going to start a holiday, I think you have to connect a food with it to be successful. I think that's one of the prerequisites.
If it's going to be Evacuation Day, maybe it should be prunes.
Well, the other thing, I mean, the book's not just about November, but while we're in November, the other thing that the holiday I do sort of, well, it's not really a holiday, but it is kind of personally. When my wife and I first married, on our first anniversary, in fact, we ended up, for work reasons, moving to Europe. And we happened to take a trip to Paris on the third Thursday of November, which at the time I didn't realize was when the Beaujolais Nouveau, the wine, was released. And so it was kind of a big celebration going on throughout the city. So ever since then, she and I have sort of celebrated that as our own sort of personal holidays, you know, symbolizing new beginnings and that sort of thing. But again, that's just sort of personal. I don't really expect anyone else to do that, which is one of the things, I guess, that prompted some of the musings in the book, which is that some holidays do have this sort of compulsory or semi-compulsory aspect to them, which I don't always appreciate. So I'm more than willing to have a little household celebration that people can participate if they want, but if they don't, that's fine too.
What aspect do you find compulsory about certain holidays?
I know this gets into controversial areas, but every...
Yay, bring it on.
You'll hear, there'll be the controversy or pseudo-controversy about whether you should say Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays or what have you. But there is often an assumption that with the big holidays, like Christmas, for instance, well, of course you celebrate Christmas. Even people I know who aren't religious often celebrate Christmas, and I've always found that a little odd, not because I don't understand people wanting to get together with friends and family and, like you said, having a nice meal. Well, that's fine, but I sort of think, well, I'm not a Christian. I don't need to celebrate this, so there's often this sort of befuddlement among people if you try to complain that, no, thanks, not for me. It's just sort of taken as a given that you're going to celebrate these things.
We do a lot of winter solstice celebrating in our area just because it's a really good reason and it's the same general time of year. And it's really fun to say to people, oh, you're, you know, they say you're going to a Christmas party. I'm like, no, winter solstice. And it usually stops people cold, which is a bit controversial. And then it's a lovely opportunity for educating about what it actually is and that there are a lot of other things going on besides the made up version of the Christ's birth story.
Right.
I actually do celebrate Christmas each year, probably because I guess I'm a cultural Christian, if you would. Secular Catholic, if that's a term even. I have kids now. Do you have any recommendations on how to kind of bring the traditional joy of Christmas to children without the kind of religious overtones?
Well, that's a good question, and I'm sure it is a tricky issue to wrestle with for people who have children. I don't have children, so I never really had to sort that one out personally. And my wife, who has the same general outlook as I do, has, you know, said, you know, if we did have children, I might want to do this because a lot of holidays seem like they'd be a lot of fun for mm-hmm. children. But then she thinks it's strange, you know, that some people continue to do it if they don't believe in the thing that's at least nominally being celebrated. But it's a tricky thing. And I mean, I wouldn't presume, like I said, not having children, to tell anyone else how they should raise them. But I can see it being a complicated issue to, on the one hand, celebrate it, but on the other hand, try to explain not really believing in a lot of what's associated with the holiday. So it does seem like there's some really thorny issues. In a way that if you say, well, we don't celebrate that because we don't believe this or want to encourage belief in this, then it's, I could see it being an easier conversation, but maybe a harder thing to have a kid understand when all of her friends are celebrating.
Do you do any kind of gift giving or acknowledgement of the end of the year or anything like that between you and your wife?
Well, actually, my birthday falls at the end of the year. I welcome any gifts that people want to give me.
You can give your personal address out at the end of the interview. People can ship it right to you.
We do have our sort of New Year's Eve traditions. I mean, we don't, you know, go out and celebrate or anything like that, but, you know, we have our little routines at home. But Christmas, I can pretty much do without, so.
Yeah, I like the Beaujolais Nouveau, actually. I think I might find out when each one of the different wine harvests come in and start adding those to my calendar.
Yeah, I enjoy it.
Is that a huge holiday across France, or is that more of like a individual family type thing?
Well, my sense was that it's not necessarily a holiday in the sense of, you know, banks closing, but it seems to be a pretty widespread thing. I mean, it's almost like, even if you're in a city, an almost agricultural harvest fest kind of thing in a way. So at least that was my impression.
I like that. Food and wine, baby. That's what we always need to celebrate.
Absolutely. We should all get a day off and just, like, get to party.
Yep.
Paid holiday.
Bacchanalia.
So I was thinking that we should eliminate one of our federal holidays, and I'm curious your thoughts on this. So this seems like something that would be fun to do and would really drive people crazy, but what if we eliminated Columbus Day and replaced it with Election Day? And anybody in favor of this is for democracy, and anybody opposed is for genocide and slavery. What are your thoughts on that, John? Do you support my proposal?
I'd be fine with it, but what it makes me think of is how, I lived in New York for a while, and in New York, Columbus Day has sort of become de facto Italian-American Day. So that's the day there'll be a big parade. New Yorkers seem to love a parade, and there's a, you know, parade for any what are essentially ethnically oriented days. So St. Patrick's Day will be Irish American Day, Columbus Day is Italian American Day. So there I could see the genocide argument not going over quite as well because not respecting our heritage, that sort of argument coming up. Although, I mean, believe me, I'm with you, but I can see some people.
Some people would be upset
reacting
about
a little less favorably.
they wouldn't like us pointing out the genocidal heritage? Damn.
In my experience, no, people don't respond favorably.
Too bad if we offend them.
Is there anything else that you'd like our listeners to know about your book?
Well, like I said, in some cases I do tell some other people's stories because there are some stories that are really quite fascinating. Often they have a very religious aspect. For example, some people know or may have known but forgotten the fatwa, the sort of death penalty Ayatollah Khomeini issued against Salman Rushdie came down on St. Valentine's Day. And then several years later, he proposed to one of his wives on Valentine's Day. So there's, in one of his novels, that's also an important date. So there's an interesting story there with his, which of course is a religious story. But then I have another essay or another chapter in there on the first African-American heavyweight champion of the world, Jack Johnson, who won an important fight on the 4th of July. So there's an interesting story about race in America relating to the 4th of July and Jack Johnson's fight. Hmm. And Labor Day, which of course is one of the very few secular holidays, although religious components have been grafted onto it over the years, is a good Eugene Debs story. So in addition to my own personal experiences, I do interweave a lot of historical stories that I hope readers would find interesting.
To me, Labor Day seems pretty straightforward secular. What have religious groups tried to do to take that over?
The most basic level, there are often, in addition to the parade, there are mass services. For a long time, the AFL-CIO would have a segment on their website, Labor in the Pulpits. And then historically, there's a long sort of heritage of the Catholic Church in particular trying to sort of co-opt the labor movement sort of keeping it from going too far left, more towards supporting the status quo rather than efforts to change it. Some interesting and sometimes sort of tragic intersections, but it was certainly some colorful history.
Excellent. Well, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you.
Thanks a lot, John. Appreciate having you on the show, man.
Thanks.
Next, we welcome Lori A. Egan, the author of The Outcast Oracle and Fog and Other Stories. She also has a psychological suspense novel called Jenny Kidd, as well as two poetry collections, one called Snow, Shadows, and a Stranger, and another called Beneath the Lion's Paw. Her work has received nominations for two Pushcart Prizes, as well as Best of the Web and Best of the Net, and her work has appeared in over 35 literary journals. So we welcome Lori today. Welcome, Lori.
Thank you for having me on this broadcast. That's really nice.
Tell our listeners a little bit, kind of an overview of the book and some of the things and themes that you really wanted to hit on and get across.
Okay.
Without giving away too much.
No, I know.
Surprises for later.
One of the things that was really interesting about this book is that I did not intend to write a young adult novel, and I think Mark Twain probably felt much the same way. In fact, there's a little bit of that Mark Twain-style sort of satirical wry humor in this book. So as a result, I've had a lot of very good feedback from adult readers who have enjoyed it, male and female, all ages. So it should apply also to teenage market. I would really like to see everybody try it. The book is essentially about a young 14-year-old girl set in 1959, and she is dealing with all kinds of issues. Her grandfather is a real con artist, a charming fellow, very independent kind of character, and he's got a whiskey mill. He's got all kinds of con jobs that he's doing, but mostly he is running his own little minister show in the house and has a lot of people coming in order to put some money in the plate, and that's what he's enjoying doing. And he's really essentially a con guy, but really loves Charlie, the main character. And slowly she becomes very involved with all of his various endeavors, and so there's a really wonderful relationship that they have here. So the religion is sort of tongue-in-cheek in terms of they don't really believe in what they're doing, but they're figuring if people are happy enough to come and listen to them and put some money on the plate, that's what they're there for. So those are some of the themes about it. The book was not really written specifically for the humanist market, but it really wound up being a great title and a great fit, I think, for Humanist Press, and I'm very grateful to them for publishing the book.
You said it wasn't specifically designed for a humanist audience. Who did you kind of have in mind as your audience when you were writing it?
I didn't really. to be honest, I have a sort of habit on a number of my projects where I get a voice in my head that comes out of nowhere, and I just sort of hold on for the ride. And this was the case here. I really didn't have a preconceived notion about this title, and all of a sudden, because of all this sort of satire about religion and other things as well, I realized that this would be a really wonderful book for the humanist market, and it was sort of the book that I wish I had had when I was that younger age, because there really wasn't anything back then. And, you know, the book has got some charm and some humor, but then there's also some drama, a little romance, and some danger. So it's a really interesting mix.
It sounds like the beginning of The Princess Bride, which is my favorite movie. There's a little something for everyone. Sword fights,
yeah.
And yeah, maybe not in your book. But
are there sword fights?
Well, I think it's, you know, I think it is a pretty interesting tale, and I think it is appropriate for a lot of different people. I don't think it's a really narrow market at all. And I think even religious people would at least enjoy the humor. The jabs are pretty nice, really, for the most part, about religion and religious practices.
Is there a particular religion you're jabbing, or is it kind of across the board? And
sort of
what...
across the board. You know, I think at one point there's a character that comes in sort of midpoint in the novel who, I guess, had been raised as a Catholic. So there's a little bit of tongue-in-cheek stuff about him knowing how to sort of dress up everything. I mean, he all of a sudden wanted to get Charlie dressed up in this gown with this big cross, and, you know, so he's more in for the show of it, and she figures that that's what, you know, Catholics do and why they're so successful. So she figures, all right, I'll go along with it. So she really wasn't too happy about being involved with the whole oracle thing, which is what he wanted her to be in order to make more money.
How do you handle the question of moral ambiguity in this story? It sounds like you've got characters that are kind of doing some underhanded, con artist-y type things, but they're also charismatic, and this is must be kind of a tough balance to walk when you're writing the story. So how do you handle these questions of characters not being purely good or purely evil?
Well, I think that's human nature. Going back to Mark Twain again, he had much the same kind of thing. Because of the sort of charming quality of the grandfather, who is the con artist, who really isn't really mean, he just uses and manipulates. So he's sort of a lovable character in many ways, and he really has some positive attributes. It is difficult to sort of deal with the ambiguity of this kind of thing, and I don't know. I think you just have to write it and hope that readers will feel sympathetic for what the main character is going through and how she makes her ultimate decisions about what is good for her to do, what is right for her to do, and, you know, going through that entire process and seeing her history both, you know, in the backstory as well as, you know, in current as you're reading along. So I think it is a tricky problem.
Lori, I see that also that you have written a book called Fog and Other Stories, which is also published by the Humanist Press. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. This book was originally issued by another publisher who closed his doors, and it was really nice of Humanist Press to pick it up. This title has 23 stories that deal with a sort of the concept of fog in terms of dreams, grief, sorrow, jealousy, romance, all kinds of aspects, including one story set in Ireland, which really has some fog in it. this book is really, I'm really very proud of this book because most of these stories have been published in literary journals. The connection to the humanist concept is probably not as strong as in the Outcast Oracle, though there are several stories that are very pertinent. But, you know, I think the whole book was written through my mindset, which is humanist, and I think that comes across. So this is a little different book for this publisher, I believe, and I'll be very interested to see how it does. I'm very pleased. It's very diverse in terms of the subject material. The style even is diverse. Some of the stories are very literary. Some are just good reads. It's a very, very diverse collection.
You wrote us before the interview about how in Fog you touched on a concept that's really interesting to you, and when I read your email, it actually sounded kind of fascinating to me. So I wanted to ask you about the concept of creative children going away from the crowd and being independent and even going away from the religious crowd. And tell us about how you touch on that.
Well, I think The Outcast Oracle is a very fine example of that, but Fog has a number of young characters who are grappling with all kinds of issues. My own background is I was the only child, and my parents pretty much did whatever they felt like doing. They were both very independent, so I had a lot of time to myself, and it's my strong belief that children who are trying to observe and understand their relationship to the world, not only their family but their peer group, often become writers or artistic people in some fashion. And I'm fascinated with this process of the development from these kinds of childhood triangles or small areas where the kid is very much alone a lot of the time, has a lot of downtime without being overscheduled and you know, overconnected to peer group or, you know, the outside world. I think that this kind of hothouse mentality of just having everything very compressed is really good for a writer, but it also makes for very interesting characters who then later grow up and have a lot of these childhood original worlds. So like my novel Jenny Kidd, which was published by Vagabondage Press, has, again, a young artist who is pretty much on her own and is struggling. So this is a theme I come back to quite often. And I think that this is also a very strong connection to people that reject organized religion because they don't really feel so socially involved, and they're willing to take a chance and on their own independent views. And I think that's there's a good strong correlation there as well, and there was for me as you know too.
Thank you, Laurie. That was wonderful. Is there anything else you would like to share with our listeners before we let you go today?
No, but I'm really glad to have both of these books out, and I hope they do well. I've always loved to hear comments through my website, but for many readers. Fog and Other Stories is a little different, and I think people just need to go through it. They'll find something in there that they'll enjoy because the stories are very diverse.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Todd and Kim.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
All right. Bye.
All right, Todd, that was definitely a wonderful catapult of authors today.
Indeed. So, listeners, if you would like, you can send us a comment at 202-618-1371. You can like us on Facebook and check us out at thehumanisthour.org for previous episodes and show notes.
For any of the books you heard about here today that I know have piqued your interest, you can go to Humanist Press and order all of them right there. Order one, order two, order all six. 17, however many there were.
just keep ordering. Don't stop.
Don't stop. It feels good. I tell you what, it's true. When I see get my book orders in, and oh, my goodness, especially when sometimes they all come in at once, I get very happy.
You get excited about the books when they arrive. That's good.
I do. I do. I'm a girl who reads. I know it's crazy. It's crazy, but it's true.
You're doing better than me. I'm not a girl, and I don't read a lot of books, actually. I've switched over to like almost all internet reading. It feeds my ADD attention span.
Flip, flip, click.
Click,
I like
click,
it.
Click. Exactly.
Well, I have a quote that I read this week. It's from another girl. Can you handle it, Todd? Two girls, two readers, and a quote?
Absolutely. Bring it on.
This one is from Rosa Luxemburg.
Is that a country?
It is, but she isn't.
Oh.
And I'm not sure if she's from that particular, I think she's from Germany. However,
she should totally be from Luxembourg. That would be way cooler.
I know, right? And if she lived on Luxembourg Street, that would be even better.
I'm Chris Luxembourg, Luxembourg from Luxembourg.
I live on 622 Luxembourg Street. Probably the worst German accent ever. I do apologize to anyone of German descent.
But that was a perfect Luxembourgian, Ernest Borgnanian accent.
I just fell off my piano. Oh, dear. Oh, poor Rosa. Well, this is what she has to say, Todd, and it is I really, really liked this. Being human means throwing your whole life on the scales of destiny when need be, all the while rejoicing in every sunny day and every beautiful cloud. I would cross-stitch that with some clouds and some sunshine. I like that.
Can you do that for me? Can you cross-stitch that? I'll hold you to that.
All right. That sounds good. Well, this was fun. I hope everybody enjoyed it as much as we did. Thank you so much to all of our authors today and to Brian, our wonderful producer.
Until next month, thank you very much, listeners. We will talk to you then.
Absolutely. Bye, everybody. See you soon.
Leaders or listeners. I don't know what we have. Do we have readers? Do we have leaders? I don't seem to like finishing the word listeners that you think are interested. Our leader. Edit that. Our readers might find interesting.
Or our listeners. Listeners, we have for you now Susan Perry, who happens to be married to Stephen Perry, the author of Kylie's Heel, a novel, a new... I'm going to start that over again. Why? A nouvelle. A lovely nouvelle. Okay. I did. Sorry, Brian. Edit.
John, how do you pronounce your last name?
Rodwin. Pronounce the A like it's an I.
Perfect. That was our guess, but we didn't want to butcher it on air.
I appreciate that.
John Rodwan.
Yeah, there we go.
Hi, John. It's Kim.
Hi.
Woohoo! Welcome to the show, everybody.
You squealed.
I did. Oh, dear. All right, listeners, Stephen Perry has written a book called Questions About God, a book of amazing poetry from what I understand from the reviews. And I need to start that all over again, if you don't mind.
Oh, certainly not. I love being edited.
That was terrible. Yep. All right.
Just not just you.
Do you look upon the universe with wonder in your eyes? Do you tingle with attention when you're taken by surprise? If a problem should perplex you, does it put your brain in gear? Then you're ready for adventure on the science frontier. The science frontier. The science frontier. You can always be a pioneer on the science frontier. All our continents are mapped and all our shipping lanes are known, so our planet doesn't want another Ponce de Leon. But we do need great explorers with the strength to persevere, blazing off in new directions through the science frontier. The science frontier. The science frontier. Can always be a pioneer on the science frontier. Beyond the reach of scientific law, you'll find a land of untamed facts and rogue phenomena. Dark matter and dark energy, entanglement of light, pluripotent stem cells, the origins of life, cancer-fighting nanobots, magnetic monopoles, extremophile biology, the centers of black holes, genomics, climatology, the rise of humankind, informatics, wind energy, the nature of the mind. And for every mountain conquered, brand new vistas will appear. May we never see the boundary of the science frontier. The science frontier. The science frontier. The science frontier.